These days, so many foundations have strings attached to their funding that just looking and doing internal diligence on an invention disclosure that we're about to license is very difficult, very challenging. And you know, sometimes we find ourselves with conflicting terms, because obviously when a faculty gets money to support the research, nobody thinks about the downstream effect. And that's great, because at the end of the day, job of universities to do research. But then when something comes up and you have to fold it into a license and you have to look and all these strings that are attached to funding, you end up sometimes saying, oh my God, I can't license it because there are conflicting terms in these things.
Amir Nyberg has been the Associate Vice Chancellor and CEO and President of UCLA Technology Development Group since 2016, when he moved from having led YEDA, the tech transfer arm of the Weizmann Institute of Science. He joins us on Talking Tech Transfer to discuss the responsibilities of leading the tech transfer office of the US's number one ranked public university, and to ponder the intricacies of being part of a larger university system. He also tells us about the differences between Israel and the US, tackles the criticism uncovered by the UC regents that UC campuses can be difficult to negotiate with, and admits that remote working has actually made it more challenging to find tech transfer practitioners. And because you cannot talk about Los Angeles without thinking of Hollywood, he also reveals why the snowflakes in Frozen didn't generate any licensing income. Amir, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Terry, for inviting me. It's a pleasure to be here.
It's a pleasure to have you. To start with, can you give me an overview of UCLA TDG and with some key figures if you have them?
Sure. You know, so when we speak about technology transfer, first of all, we need to look at the institutions that we serve, because we're not an island. So UCLA is the number one ranked public university in the US with a research budget of more than $1.5 billion. That's billion with a B, and working hard to get that to the area of $1.7 billion this year. So it just shows you about the quality of our faculty and the breadth and depth of the research done at UCLA. So we take that huge research organization and translate it into invention disclosures. It means that on average, we get about 400 invention disclosures a year, anywhere from traditional pharmaceuticals to biomedicine, physics, and everything in between. We are able to translate that to about 50 exclusive licenses and options a year. We have a huge activity for MTAs, material transfer agreements. We do about 1,500 of those a year. We're able to bring about $60 to $70 million in industry-sponsored research. And the list just goes on and on. So it's a really, really big activity supporting the research organization that's doing so well in UCLA in recent years.
You said number one in the US. How does your work fit into the wider UC system?
It's a benefit and a challenge. The benefit is that we have, in the UC system, we have 10 campuses and two national labs. So that's one of the best support systems for technology transfer, right? So if we have a question, we want to look into new developments in the way people do business, we always have our peer group to talk to, and we meet on a regular basis and exchange views and best practices. And that's like an awesome feature of the system. On the flip side, the UC system can be viewed as very bureaucratic. And I think we probably will talk about it a little bit later. The Regents Work Group pointed out that the UC system maybe is viewed by the outside world as being tough to negotiate with. And I think that is attributed to the fact that there are some functions in our system that are still centralized. And so some of the challenges come from that fact that the decentralization process is not complete. And some things that we need to do very locally are still practiced on a system-wide basis.
Are there any elements that you would like to copy from other TTOs within UC, or something that you think they would benefit taking over from you?
I came to UCLA from Israel, from the Weizmann Institute of Science, leading very high quality but a fairly small tech transfer office. And what I used to do, and I'm still doing, is remind myself all the time that technology transfer is a very local business. It's a business that's attached to the local ecosystem. Copying is not kind of the right verb to use here. It's more inspirational, and we're always looking into best practices and things that other campuses are doing worldwide and see how we can adapt and change them to fit our local ecosystem. Just to give you some examples, we have a program called Startup in a Box. We didn't invent it, but we kind of tailored it to our needs, to our faculty needs, where we are helping some of our faculty launch their first business by connecting them to investors, to lawyers, to accountants that can guide them through this process. You know, our community is a very collaborative community. And so when someone launches a new program, they're always happy to share. And we are always glad to take it in and implement it and adapt it to our own local system. I can tell you that one of the novel things that UCLA has done recently, and we're happy to share that, is the concept of how to reach through the products developed in university to underserved communities. And we received a request from a student advocacy group telling us, look, guys, you need to look at the broader picture here. I mean, it's great that you're helping bring products to the market, but you also need to look at to underserved communities where may not be able to afford these great products and medicines of tomorrow. And so we went into a journey with a WHO organization called a Medicine Patent Pool, MPP. And we agreed with them on a language that puts the university in a position of a facilitator between our industrial partners, and there are no products, there are no new drugs in the market without industrial partners, without VCs, but where we'll be able in the future to facilitate a dialogue between the various advocacy group and our licensees. And we're successfully implementing this language in our license agreements, and we recently received several requests from other peer institutions to learn how are we doing this, and with the thought that they're able to implement a similar concept in their own licenses.
When you say some parts are centralized in the UC system and other parts are obviously handled by the individual offices, is that something that you expect to stay this way? Do you think more responsibility will come to the individual TTOs as you evolve tech transfer?
Yeah, so if you look at the 10 campuses right now, most of them have a very sophisticated tech transfer office. And the region's work group looking at the I&E ecosystem throughout the UC system, I'm not sharing any secrets here, right? Their discussions are open to the public, came up with the report basically lining up a roadmap to say, these are the remaining functions of the centralized office, of the Office of the President, that needs to be decentralized to campuses. So I think that in the next 2-3 years, we will see this process of decentralizing some central functions to campuses being completed.
Okay. One of the initiatives that you do run locally is the UCLA Innovation Fund. Can you tell me a little bit about this one?
Sure. So we started with this program about 4 years ago. It was seeded by money received from the state of California, AB2664. And then additional funds came from our chancellor and vice chancellor for research. And the core concept behind this is, you know, the classical bridging the gap, bridging the chasm, whatever name you want to give it, that every tech transfer office encounters, where, you know, we have great early stage technologies based on great basic science, but requires some additional investment and guidance to make sure that they become an investable opportunity. I think that what we're doing perhaps a little bit differently than other campuses is our very close partnership with the deans, with the academic deans of the School of Medicine, with the Colleges of Physical Sciences, with the College of Life Sciences. And they agreed to invest some of their own money in this activity, but they came up with a very interesting condition. They told us, look, we want to have another stage or another phase in your funnel. We want to make sure that the applications that you support really have really good science behind them. And that's a different question than the commercial aspects of it. So the way we go about and finding our opportunities is by having an open call for proposals to our campus. And then the first stage is like an NIH study group where all the applications are being peer reviewed for the merits of their science. And only the applications that go through this first stage of review pitch to a panel of investors and industry experts that are looking into market condition, competitive landscape. I think this gives us this two-stage sourcing process and gives us this additional edge or additional capability to really choose well, make wise decisions on the projects that we will support.
How easy or not is it generally to find capital for UCLA companies?
So it's changing. It really is changing. I'll tell you an interesting story. One of the first things that I've done coming to UCLA was to go and meet with the leadership of Amgen at Thousand Oaks. If you know the geography of California, that's not that far from West LA. With traffic, it may take an hour to an hour and a half to get there.
Everything in LA does, I think.
Yes. But, you know, so I met a leadership team. I told him, hey, guys, you know, it was easier for me to see you, to meet you in Israel than it is for us to meet in California, because everybody's so afraid from traffic. And when you travel internationally, you make the time and you go and visit with other academic institutions and tech transfer offices. So as a result of that meeting, a new event was born. It's called now LA Best. And the concept behind it was to bring all the stakeholders in LA County to a single location. And we were able to grow this event from 300 people, and this year will probably be over 1,000 by invitation only. So to make a long story short, the time was right for LA to become a leader in sourcing capital. And we have some now local VC funds specializing in the LA County or LA metropolitan area. And if you look, I recently saw recent PitchBook data, as far as VC investment in our county, we reached Boston, and which now considered to be a hub for VC investment. And we think that we are in the trajectory to pass them just based on the quality and the numbers of academic institutions and leading hospitals we have in our county.
What about talent? Is that easy to come by? Are there enough people wanting to work for startups in LA?
That is still a challenge. That is still a challenge because we don't have the density that some of the big traditional tech hubs have, you know, like a Bay Area, even San Diego, obviously Boston. And so that is a challenge. Although once people come to LA, they fall in love with the weather in the area, but it's hard to convince them because they don't have the density of peer talent or even looking for the next job after the startup company. And cost of living in LA is also not cheap. So there are several organizations looking into this issue of talent. One is Bioscience LA. Another one, where I'm a board member, is the Alliance for Southern California Innovation. And all of these think tanks and work groups are thinking on how can we bring more talent to LA County and Southern California in general to support the needs of our startup companies.
Do your startups generally try and stay in LA then when they are founded, or do they move on up to Silicon Valley or maybe Boston or elsewhere?
So this is also changing. You know, when I arrived to LA 5 years ago, the pattern was a startup is being created, perhaps spend their first year or so in a local incubator, but then as soon as they get their first big A round, they'll probably relocate most of the time to the Bay Area because it's, you know, the closest. Now we're seeing in front of our eyes the formation of one significant hub for cell therapy, where LA is becoming a global leader in startup companies dealing with cell therapy. And they tend to stick around. They tend to stay in our area. We have more and more incubators and spaces for growth companies and capital now becoming more readily available, for at least for life sciences. And so we find that more and more of these companies stick around and stay next to their, you know, to the talent that created them.
How easy or not is it to find staff for your own office in LA?
That is a challenge. But that is, you know, I recently came back from the AUTM annual conference, and it seems that everyone in our industry is looking for talent. It's very, very challenging. You know, we're competing for talent with the big tech companies, with biotechs and so on. And for an academic institution, that's a very, to almost impossible competition. We're trying very hard, but it's not easy to recruit talent. Hopefully, one of the things we learned from COVID is that at least partially we can work remotely. And so currently my office is now working on a hybrid model where people have to come into the office only twice a week. And so that allows us to cast a wider net and find people that perhaps will otherwise be reluctant to go into a car and spend 2 hours in traffic and say, okay, if I only do it twice a week, it's not that bad. But still, currently, the market for talent is very, very hot, and it's hard, very hard to find experienced people.
Is that something that has historically been true as well, or is that a recent development?
I think historically, it was easier to find perhaps people with 2 to 3 years of experience that would say, you know, we don't want the lifestyle of consulting or big tech companies where we have to be on planes all day and the work-life balance wasn't that good for them. And say, okay, we're willing perhaps to take a salary cut and spend some time in academia and learn a very interesting, a unique profession. We are not seeing that often these days. I think, again, this is one of the influences of COVID, that even all the big consulting firms, legal firms and so on, they're also allowing more flexibility to their staff. And so people are less inclined to move out of there.
Do you run any student internship programs or PhD programs to get staff into TDG?
Yeah, we do. And what we learned over time is that that line of being a student intern in TDG really helps students secure their first job out of college or out of grad school. We have a number of programs like that. We have one program of tech fellows. They help our business development team, first of all, in kind of formulating and drafting the non-disclosure, you know, one-pager documents we have for each technologies. They will help prepare quick PowerPoint decks that we can use for presentations. And they also help just in reaching out and finding the appropriate people and kind of nudge them with opportunities. Another program that we have is with our new venture group, and that student group helped our innovation fund that we mentioned earlier and kind of walk faculty that are accepted to that program through the process of building a pitch deck and finding some market comparables, you know, understanding what the competition is and building a true commercial deck or a deck that translates science into commercial actionable items. So all of these programs are working very well. We also have a few students that just come and help us with data entry and so on, because we're data intensive industry. And that is definitely one of the biggest advantages of working next to a big university, where we can find anything from graduate students to MBA students. All are eager to get their feet wet and experience in the things that we're doing.
How big is your office at the moment? How many staff do you have?
So fully staffed, we should be 50 strong. Fortunately, in the last year or so, we've been hovering around 46, 47 people. It's not as bad as some of the other offices, but we really want to be fully staffed again.
I can understand that. You touched on the UC Regents report earlier. I think it's called From Discovery to Societal Impact. And it said that faculty across the campuses wanted their entrepreneurship and valued and celebrated more. And it said, as you said, the UC system can be considered a difficult partner. And its general inclination toward caution circumscribes its ability to take advantage of business opportunities. How are you supporting this culture shift towards more entrepreneurialism at UCLA?
When you speak about 10 campuses and UC system, it's sometimes hard. You may get lost and lose sight of the granular picture of each campus. And I think the UCLA campus is a very well positioned to capture I&E activity. And we have many, many faculty members who are very entrepreneurial. Having said that, we are always building programs and trying to reach out to faculty who either do not want to be entrepreneurs or don't know how. So let me tell you about two of these programs. One is Faculty Innovation Fellows. It's a program we run together with Startup UCLA. And what we've done there is to take a program that was designed for undergrad students for their summer accelerator program, their capstone summer accelerator program. And with our good friend at Startup UCLA, we have converted that program into an educational program for faculty. So instead of a quick summer accelerator, this is a few months long, which really teaches them how to go about and form their first business from a very methodical educational point of view. Similarly, we're very close to our campus biodesign program, where faculty from UCLA Health are able to explore and find problems on campus and then offer novel solutions for them. And that has proven to be a very good pipeline for our innovation fund, novel solution to known problems to people who live in hospitals. Now, additionally, we're working very hard in building longer-term relationships with some of our local investors, entities like Autobahn or even Amazon that recently announced building a center with UCLA for AI. So all of these, let's call them structures that are already in place, reduces the friction and hopefully allows faculty that otherwise would say, hey, I don't know what to do, to go and be an entrepreneur, say, okay, you don't need to take all of that work on yourself because we have these structures ready and we can help you find, you know, your first CEO or work in a very seamless and smooth way with industry. So, you know, the structures with entities like Amazon, Cisco, and Autobahn Labs really help increase the circle of people that are willing to engage in this type of activity.
How do you generally entice corporate partners to come to UCLA? What gets them to pay attention to you?
It's a lot of work from our faculty. What we bring these entities to our campuses is the quality of our faculty. And, you know, as I mentioned, when we started, our faculty are just amazing and they're able to bring and receive significant amounts of research dollars. And so that's becoming a known quality throughout the world. And then it's an open dialogue. And what we are able to say to these companies these days, you know, we are so flexible that whatever business structure that you would like to build with us, we will try to accommodate that. There are some, you know, basic principles of licensing from an academic institution that we have to make sure that they are in our agreements, like the right to publish, like the industrial partner obligation to identify the university and things like that. But other than that, whatever structure that works to our partner, we can probably find a good solution that will fit that structure. And so through that ongoing dialogue with, you know, people in my office that are experts in their fields, in their respective fields, from AI all the way through to drug development, we're able to build these longer term relationships. Again, everything is based on the quality of our faculty and their research.
What are the challenges that remain?
The biggest challenge these days is actually the sponsor terms for research. Now, when I started working in tech transfer almost 20 years ago, when we used to get an invention disclosure, we used to say, okay, that's federal funding, that's governmental funding, no strings attached. We can license it out pretty quickly and smoothly, you know, theoretical margin rights and so on, but everybody kind of learned to live with them. These days, so many foundations have strings attached to their funding that just looking and doing internal diligence on an invention disclosure that we're about to license is very difficult, very challenging. And, you know, sometimes we find ourselves with conflicting terms because obviously, when a faculty gets money to support the research, nobody thinks about the downstream effect. And that's great because at the end of the day, job of universities is to do research. But then when something comes up and you have to fold it into a license and you have to look at all these strings that are attached to funding, you end up sometimes saying, oh my God, I can't license it because there are conflicting terms in these things. And we find ourselves doing more and more work, first of all, mapping these terms and then speaking with foundations that tell me, hey guys, you're actually hurting your public mission in curing a certain disease or addressing a certain problem because of the terms you impose on your funding. And that is taking more and more time. And I would wish that have some open dialogue and standardization of these terms with foundations that will allow everybody to serve their missions.
I can only imagine that it's frustrating. I would have hoped that it has become easier over time rather than the terms becoming more onerous and more complex.
Unfortunately, it's getting more and more complicated as time passes by because some of these foundations at least think in tech transfer, not only a mission of bringing products to the market, but also in a way to replenish the money that they invested or the money that they gave as philanthropy. That makes life really complicated.
One other thing that is a complex problem at the moment is diversity and inclusion. How does UCLA fare when it comes to that?
There's incredible focus in UCLA about this issue. We are an urban campus operating in one of the most diverse cities in the world. So there's an incredible focus on bringing first generations into our colleges. Even in our research organization, there is a work group looking on how to diversify the workforce in the administration. You know, we have a dashboard where every time we hire someone, we take a look at our dashboard and say, hey, we need to do better in this area or that area. It's a university-wide effort that is ongoing, and we're already seeing the results of that effort.
That is really good to hear. I want to talk about your own career as well. You already mentioned you worked in Israel. You were general counsel of Bieda Research and Development at the Weizmann Institute, and then you became its CEO. How did you make the move from general counsel to CEO, and why did you make that step?
It's really a question of coincidences. I finished my master's degree in copyrights in the internet in the University of Connecticut. I returned to Israel and started working as a lawyer in a private law firm, doing the kind of the first terms of use for websites. And then, you know, just before the bubble burst, everybody who knew something about internet and terms of use was, you know, at the time in Israel, was working in a startup and having big dreams. And for some reason, I interviewed for this odd entity that I never heard about before called YEDA, the Weizmann Institute of Science. And I took that job and I didn't go to work at a startup company. And then a few years after that, one of the main expert traditions in YEDA is that the CEOs of YEDA are being poached by other academic institutions to build their organizations. So my predecessor was reallocating to build the tech transfer office in the University of Sydney, Australia. And I said, you know, I want his job. And so I kind of ran to that position and I was thankful to become the CEO of YEDA. At the time, was the youngest CEO of YEDA, the youngest person ever appointed to be the CEO of YEDA. And the funny thing is that they told me that they appointed me to the CEO, it was 2006, at my birthday. And so, you know, fast forwarding time to 2016, when I was recruited to UCLA, I was doing my last rounds of interviews in UCLA at my birthday. and again, so it's April. So and again, I received the job offer from UCLA on April 2016. And 3 months after that, I was already working on campus.
Wow. What prompted your move to UCLA? Was it just time for something else?
Yeah, precisely. It was time to do something else. I had a great run at the Weizmann Institute of Science. But then both myself and my wife, we were kind of sick of our existing jobs and wanted to change. And our kids were the appropriate age to do something else. And then, you know, I received this email from an international search firm and told me, hey, how about UCLA? And as soon as I look at the data, I said, hey, that's a great opportunity. That's a big public school with a great research organization, you know, number one public school in the US, but really with a tech transfer organization that was left behind. And the challenge of transforming that dormant organization into a leading organization just appealed to me. It was a very quick process, as I said. I was coming to UCLA during my birthday, Passover 2016. Then I came one more time with my wife looking for apartments, and we made the move with our entire family. You know, and it's been a great ride ever since.
Yeah, that would have been my next question. What was the past 6 years like?
It was great. You know, as everything else, beginnings are tough, and upscaling the things I knew how to do from YEDA to a huge organization like UCLA, that wasn't a simple process. But the atmosphere on campus, the atmosphere in Los Angeles is so welcoming, so multicultural that it really made my life easy in moving my family here and then allowing me to focus on work. And you know, within, I would say, 18 months to 2 years to transform the organization to what we're seeing today, which I hope people view us as really cutting edge, state of the art, nimble organization able to facilitate transition of technologies from the lab to the market. And also on the flip side, bring research dollars from industry back to the campus.
What is your view of the US ecosystem more broadly outside of UC or even California in general?
It's really the best. It's a rare combination of ample resources from very sophisticated and supporting VCs to good incubators and accelerators to cutting edge science. And when you put it all together and mix it up, you get, you know, these amazing companies. And so, you know, it's been truly a learning experience on how this very sophisticated ecosystem works together when all the right ingredients exist in the same place.
How does it compare to Israel? Is there anything that either country could learn from the other one?
So, you know, in Israel, it's the entrepreneurial spirit is everywhere, and it's the let's do it mentality, which is great for companies in their early stage. It's a very efficient ratio of investment to achievement of goals. But then sometimes Israeli companies lack the discipline of growth, especially in life science, when you need the experience and management, C-level management, to know how to bring product to the market, how to develop a pharmaceutical, which is, you need the playbook, right? You need to know how to work with the FDA. You need to know what experiments to do and how to design them. And that is something that the Israeli ecosystem is still somewhat lacking. You know, we compensate that in Israel with enthusiasm and being efficient, but in many cases, unfortunately, it doesn't get you all the way. It gets you a lot of bang for high tech, but not so much in life sciences. I would say the one thing that Israel does very well is the governmental support program to tech transfer. So the government in Israel has direct programs to support tech transfer. where they reduced the risk for industry and investors to engage in this probably risky process of taking early stage basic scientific work and investing private money into it with the hope that, you know, 5 to 10 years from now, it will become a program. The Israeli government has direct support programs that reduces that risk. Now, I would like to see some of these programs in the US. We don't have those these days.
What is your vision for TDG's future?
We would like to continue and grow our ecosystem. I think we're just touching the tip of the iceberg right now and reach out to more and more faculty and partner with more and more community partners and build a vibrant ecosystem around our campus. We are always planning and hoping to reach out to new audiences and new faculty members on campus, not just the traditional people from School of Medicine and Engineering, but also reach out to the humanities, School of Art and Television and Theater, and thinking about how to expand our reach to those areas as well. We're looking how to expand our activities and serve more audiences on campus and can make our tent bigger so more people can engage and come and be part of that INE experience that we can offer.
Are there any innovations that have come out of media studies in LA that have been successes, whether they're licensing agreements or spin-outs?
None that I know of. There's a famous story on our campus that one of our faculty members wrote the algorithm for the snowflakes in Frozen. The snowflakes are falling very realistically in Frozen. But he released that code in an open source. And so Disney were able to just use it with the help of his students and not through a traditional way of technology transfer. So, some people may call it a success. It's a tech transfer process, perhaps not the most economically efficient one, but that did happen. I can't think of a true startup that came out through our office that serves that community. By the way, one of the things what we're doing, we have an external board of directors. We're looking to recruit to that board of directors people coming from the media industry. And so we can be closer to that industry and understand how we can work with them, because obviously you can't speak about LA without media. So think about what are the different ways our office can expand and reach out and work more collaboratively with film industry.
Are there any, other than the snowflakes, which wasn't a traditional tech transfer, are there any successes out of UCLA that you would like to highlight or that you're particularly proud of?
Sure, I can name a few. This is not to say they are the only ones or they are the important ones, because we have so many. One company is a company called Theseus AI, and that's a company created one of our surgeons, and basically it's an AI platform that helps a surgeon determine if someone needs a back surgery or not. And the nice thing about this is that one of my staff members is also an attending doctor. He did his own tech transfer and moved from our office to be the first employee of that company. They just finished their fundraising and they're up and running. So that's a nice, fun story. Another company, it's called Nanotech Energy. They recently raised a lot of money and building a manufacturing facility in Nevada. And what they're doing is build and manufacture non-flammable batteries. So, we would not see this Tesla after accidents going into a fireball, a ball of flames that is unextinguishable. I know the fire department is working for hours on those fires. And so with these new batteries, those fires won't happen again because they're non-flammable. And then lastly, we were able to spin out two companies from a single lab. That's the lab of Professor Dennis Lehman. He's a guru of developing novel drugs to fight cancer. And we're able to spin out two companies from his lab. One is a joint project with Caltech, where he's screening small chemical entities designed and developed at Caltech. And another company is around novel antibodies that are, again, engineered at UCLA, the Sleiman Lab, and then tested in his high-throughput screening assay. And so both of these companies are doing extremely well and already have several clinical trials ongoing based on these molecules and antibodies.
Amazing. Those are some very good choices, I think. I'll move back to the question of finding staff. Is there anything that you would say to someone who is starting out in tech transfer today?
It's an amazing career. You never get bored. There's no downtime. There isn't a dull moment. So if people don't like to get bored, like myself, it's an amazing career. But what's nice about it is, you can wake up in the morning and speak about science with someone who is a Nobel laureate. or, you know, won an incredible number of awards around their scientific work, and then in the afternoon negotiate a deal with $1,500 partner in a big law firm around the license agreement. And the following day, you'll be looking into a sub-license to a company that signed, a startup company that grew and is now signing a deal with, you know, a tech giant or big pharma. So that type of diversity within science, business, and law, I think is so interesting that it's really hard to compete with it.
Is there anything that you would change about tech transfer, either at UCLA or as a profession more broadly?
I think it's an underappreciated profession. And so as practitioners, I should do a better job in explaining exactly what we do and the value we bring to our respective institutions. In UCLA, we're very lucky that our chancellor really understands what we're doing. He's personally involved and personally kind of helped and visioned the recreation of our organization 5 or 6 years ago. But that's not the same. That's not the case in other campuses. And so the explanation of the need and societal good that we bring to our ecosystem is very important, and we need to work on that.
That almost brings us to the end. Is there anything else we have not talked about that you want people to know about UCLA?
No, come to UCLA. Every time I speak with someone, they're sitting miserable somewhere with an awful weather, and we tell them, hey, you know, that's the view outside my office, and it's sunny. It's sunny in January, it's sunny in February, it's sunny 360 days of the year, but it's not humid. And so most people, when they come, they have this image of foggy LA and so on. That's not true anymore. It's a really, really wonderful place to live in. And if you're considering pursuing an academic career, pursuing a career in tech transfer, or just building a new business, please consider the LA County as your next house.
LA is probably one of the favorite places that I have ever been to. And sadly, it's been a few years because of COVID since I've been there. But yeah, it's definitely a really great place. Other than the traffic, it is a beautiful place to be.
That's true. But it is getting better. And then there's actually ongoing construction. So before the Olympics, we'll have a decent metro and subway system, and that will improve things dramatically.
Amazing. Amir, thank you so much for taking time to talk to me today. It's been a real pleasure.
Thank you for inviting me, and it's been a pleasure as well. Thank you.
Talking Tech Transfer is hosted by me, Thierry Helas. If this is your first time listening, make sure to hit that subscribe button and peruse our archive of more than 50 interviews. This podcast is a production by Global University Venturing, a Morsonia Limited publication. You can find our website at globalventuring.com/university, on Twitter at GUVenturing, and on LinkedIn as Global University Venturing. Our sound engineer is Mark Chatterley from In-Ear Production. You can find out more about them at ineerproduction.com. If you have any comments or are interested in being a guest on a future episode, feel free to email me at thelis@globalventuring.com. That's thelis@globalventuring.com. We'd also really love it if you left us a review on Apple Podcasts, and if you haven't yet, do recommend this podcast to your friends and colleagues, or maybe even share it on LinkedIn or Twitter. Until next time, goodbye.